Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. This is where the past meets the future.
The spice.
In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are wondering about why we are here, where we came from, or what the purpose of life is, you might discover it here. Whether you are driving across the frozen tundra tonight or working on your favorite project, you might go places you haven't been before, a little past your imagination maybe, but have no fear, you will safely be traveling with us. By the way, we decided to launch this a little bit early. I know it's not quite the end of 2012 yet, but just in case, you know what happens. We want you to be able to enjoy X Squared Radio live on TV. Oh yeah, it's not just radio tonight, it's radio TV. Let me give a shout out to my people at Truth Frequency Network. My good friend Chris Geo running that network along with his wife. So here's how you do it. You go to ustream.tv, that's U-S-T-R-E-A-M, ustream.tv/channel/BBS-radio-station-2. You run that by you again. ustream.tv/channel/BBS-radio-station-2, because we're on channel 2. And you'll be able to watch the program tonight live on TV. We'll give that link out a few more times if you missed it. Our telephone numbers here through Paradise, California, anywhere North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else off planet or on planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us, 530-413-9537, 530-413-9537. You can also get to us through Skype at BBS Radio 2, the number 2, BBS Radio 2. Also, if you want to go out and do Christmas shopping, I don't recommend it. I would rather go during the day. But you can do that and still listen to the program on your cell phone one of two ways. You can either dial 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000, and then the passcode 769-608-POUND. 769-608-POUND. Or you could just go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com and click on the Droid app. Download it to your phone and you're one click away from X Squared Radio. The solar wind tonight is 339 kilometers per second. Just barely a breeze out there. And there are three sunspot clusters. None of them are pointed at us right now. Everything is safe. And you're safe here with us. Got so much to go over today. It's really, really incredible. There are, and we have a series that we're getting ready to start. Next week we have Dr. Hilde coming on the program. We're going to talk about all kinds of things, not the least of which is transhumanism. We're going to cover that a little bit tonight to try to get into the subject. I know it's kind of breaking news. It really hasn't been in the news that much. Some of the other radio programs have covered it a little bit with one or two guests, but not from a scientific point of view. And that's what we're most concerned with right here. Right now, hold on a second. Got a quick bleep from the studio. Let's see what this is. All right. By the way, if you want to go to bbsradio.com, you can find the link that I just gave you for the ustream.tv, and you can watch the program live on TV right now, because we are now broadcasting. And there won't be any charge for this until we figure out how to charge you. Hundreds of thousands of genetically modified, no, not corn, mosquitoes are set to be released into the Florida Keys in an experiment to fight dengue fever. The non-biting male mosquitoes, genetically modified, would pass along a birth defect, killing their progeny before reaching maturity. After a few generations, officials say Key West's Aedes aegypti population would die off, reducing risk of dengue fever. Florida Keys Mosquito Control District modified genes will disappear after the mosquitoes carrying it die, making no permanent change to wild population. In other words, they're going to go out there and make a lot of female mosquitoes very happy, and that's pretty much going to be the end of it. Everyone dies of old age. Hundreds of thousands of these are going to be released. The mosquito control officials have requested the Food and Drug Administration sign off on the experiment that would be the first of its kind in the U.S. Some residents of the tourist town of Key West worry, though, on how much research has been done to determine the risks of releasing genetically modified mosquitoes on the Keys' fragile ecosystem. You know, once this particular strain of mosquito dies off, it isn't going to reduce the bat population's food supply because there are other mosquitoes. They just don't carry the fever. So an entomological technician with the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District says, "Let us go." He sorts and counts dead mosquitoes in Key West, where officials are hoping to release genetically modified mosquitoes into the wild. Officials are targeting the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes because they can spread the dengue fever, a disease health officials thought had been eradicated in the U.S. until 93 cases originated in the Keys in 2009 and 2010. The trial planned by mosquito control officials and the British company Oxitec would release non-biting male mosquitoes that have been genetically modified to pass along a birth defect, as I said, to kill all the offspring. The science of it, I think, looks fine. It's straight from setting up experiments and collecting data, said Michael Doyle, pointing to research Oxitec has published in peer-reviewed scientific journals. He inherited the project when he took the lead at the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District in mid-2011. Kind of an interesting experiment. I think it should be okay. You know, if we're modifying a bug, and the bug is only going to live its life out and then die, it can't divide, it can't multiply, it can't do any other kind of mathematics with or without mosquito females. The district's website says the modified genes will disappear as soon as this generation of mosquitoes die off. There's a person named Biddle that's among those concerned about the Key West trial. He worries the modified genetic material will somehow be passed to humans or to the ecosystem, and he wants more research done. He and other Key West residents also chaff at the fact that the project was in the works long before it was made public last year. In other words, we already have these mosquitoes done and we're ready to go, and now we want the approval. Only female mosquitoes bite, by the way, so the modified genetic material wouldn't be passed on to the humans, mosquito control and Oxitec officials claim, and they also say they're being transparent about the data and the trial. Real estate agent Mila Demier has collected more than 117,700 signatures on a petition she posted on change.org against the trial. All of them come from non-scientists. Clearly shows that tourists don't support the Mosquito Control District. I think they specifically come to Key West to get the fever. A University of Florida professor who studies mosquito control said Oxitec's technology works, and evidence from the company's experiments elsewhere show it can control mosquito populations, but it's not clear whether its methods are as effective at controlling the risk of disease transmission. Phil Launibus of the Florida Medical Entomology Laboratory also said it would take repeated releases of modified mosquitoes for the program to work, and the public outcry against genetically modified organisms, even when it's irrational, may be insurmountable. It's true. But like I said, it's not corn. It's not something that's going to be ingested by anybody except maybe the bat population. If these crazy hybrid mosquitoes should happen to fly out at night, they're going to become bat bait, to be sure. The Aedes aegypti has shown resistance to pesticides used to control other species and is the most difficult for the district to manage. Common in the Southeast and the Caribbean, it lurks in standing water around homes and businesses and can breed in containers as small as a bottle cap. True enough. District inspectors go door to door to remove the standing water where they breed, a time-consuming task, given how much it rains in southern Florida. The district spends roughly $1 million a year to suppress Aedes aegypti, 10 to 15% of the agency's budget. Unfortunately, control of Aedes aegypti is a never-ending job, said Larry Hribner, the Mosquito Control District's research director. So all those little bird baths and, you know, plugged up gutters and all that kind of stuff, they all have to be cleaned out. You can't have standing water around. The only alternative is to release the genetically modified mosquito. Interesting stuff. I just think it's science maybe gone awry, but and we're going to talk a little bit more about this because there are other things being done with genetic experiments that might make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. Some powerful playing around with stuff. In 2009, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service concluded that integrating genetically modified pink bollworms bred by Oxitec to be sterile but more competitive in mating than regular bollworms into the agency's plant pest control program was the alternative and the environmentally preferable alternative to combat the cotton pest that they were dealing with. The program was discontinued, however, after officials found that the genetically modified insects were not as hardy as pink bollworms sterilized through irradiation, and that their use would cause farmers to lose their organic certification. So there are always these side effects. Oxitec said the USDA's environmental assessment is one of several examples of proof that the trials, risks, and methods are being independently evaluated. The company has trials in Brazil, the Cayman Islands, and Malaysia, and it says it's gotten positive reviews from the latter two governments. It also cites its published research in peer-reviewed journals. But Biddle, the one-time dengue patient, he actually caught the fever, wants Oxitec to continue testing the modified mosquitoes outside the U.S. Go figure. Why the rush here, the Key West man said. We already have test cases in the world where we can watch what is happening and make the best studies in someone else's backyard. Because wouldn't it be wonderful if we could find out how it could be fail-safe, which it may not be right now. It's an open Pandora's box. Yes, it is. A lot of times what we call impact of these kinds of things is not really foreseen. We don't really know how changing one organism changes the ecosystem. The bats are only one issue. What if these genetically modified mosquitoes are consumed by bats? What happens to their progeny? What happens to the prey that eat the bats and the bat young? Another thing to think about. Just thought you should know. By the way, if you're just joining us tonight, I know you're hearing my voice, but you might also want to see the program. That's right. We are now on BBS Radio TV. And very soon we'll be live on bbsradio.tv. That's right. The website is already set up. Everything's ready to go. The code is all there. We're not streaming there, though, right now. We are using Ustream's servers. So you'll have to go to bbsradio.com and click on the link right there on the front page of bbsradio.com, and you'll be able to watch X Squared Radio tonight. Now, let me tell you how this is going to go in the coming months. This is going to be interactive live news. That is to say, yes, we're still going to talk about the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. That's true enough. That never goes away. But we're going to enhance the program. So that means that if you have your smartphone with you and you see something out there live, we have about 48,000 reporters out all over the world with smartphones. You can send us the video live from your camera and we'll put it up so the world can see what you see. Now, that's never been done before on any kind of media, but we're going to do it right here on X Squared Radio. We're debuting it tonight. No, we're not going to do the streaming from your phone tonight, but that's where it's going to go in the next few weeks and months. Interactive live TV news. Instead of, you know, all of the video having to be bought and sold and going through all the copyright bullcrap, and maybe it makes the news and maybe it doesn't make the news, we can have a live interactive program to where what you see, we see. We're testing it because this is exactly the same kind of technology that we're going to use on the ship when we launch on the expedition. So just thought you should know, it's a test run. You want to be part of it, you can be part of it. You can listen to X Squared Radio live tonight, or you can tune in and you can watch it on TV. And don't forget to send in your comments and things like that. I love to read them and I answer them all. bagnew@x2-radio.com, bagnew@x2-radio.com. I also have news for cat owners. I myself am a cat owner. I like cats because they don't bark. A foodborne parasite that infects domestic cats can get inside the human brain by commandeering special cells of the immune system, which it uses as a Trojan horse to enter the central nervous system, a study has found. Scientists believe they have finally discovered the mechanism that allows Toxoplasma gondii, a single-celled parasite, to pass from the human gut to the brain, where it may cause behavioral changes. Researchers have shown that the parasite can infect the dendritic white blood cells of the immune system, causing them to secrete a chemical neurotransmitter that allows the infected cells and the parasite to cross the natural barrier protecting the brain. Toxoplasma gondii can live in many different species, but it can only complete its life cycle in cats, which secrete the parasite in their, well, in their poo, in their feces. Studies have shown that the toxoplasma affects the behavior of rats and mice, making them more likely to be eaten by cats, thereby completing parasites' complex life cycle. Latest figures released in September by the Food Standards Agency show about 1,000 people a day in Britain, 350,000 people a year, are being infected with toxoplasma. So it's not just a little problem over there in the UK, probably from either direct contact with cats or by eating poorly cooked meat or vegetables. Up to 40% of the British population, so that means no more raw foods, folks. No more raw foods. If you can't peel it, boil it. Got it? Up to 40% of the British population are believed to be infected with toxoplasma, and although the vast majority show no apparent symptoms, there is a risk to unborn children if their mothers become infected for the first time during pregnancy. However, recent studies have also suggested that toxoplasma may be a trigger for psychological disturbances in humans, including schizophrenia, although the research has fallen well short of showing a cause and effect. Antonio Bragan of Sweden's Center for Infectious Diseases at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm said that when infected with toxoplasma, human dendritic cells, which are not part of the central nervous system, begin to secrete a neurotransmitter called GABA, which is normally produced by brain cells. For toxoplasma to make cells in the immune defense to secrete GABA was as surprising as it was unexpected. This was unknown before. It means that the parasite had the capacity, potentially, to manipulate the central nervous system, said Dr. Baragani. The study, published in the online journal PLOS Pathogens, used human dendritic cells growing in a test tube, but it also showed that infected dendritic cells pass more easily than uninfected cells into the brains of laboratory mice. We've shown that it happens in human dendritic cells taken from healthy donors and also proved that the same thing happens in the mouse model. It shows that the parasite is using dendritic cells as a sort of Trojan horse to transport itself from the human gut to the brain. We've not looked at behavioral changes in people infected with toxoplasma, as that's been dealt with by previous studies. Instead, we've shown for the first time how the parasite behaves in the body of its host, by which I mean how it enters the brain and manipulates the host by taking over the brain's neurotransmitters. That's just interesting physiology. Other scientists have shown that toxoplasma is capable of producing another nerve substance called L-DOPA. You guys are familiar with that already. It's the chemical precursor to the dopamine neurotransmitter, which may be another route to altering mammalian behavior. Many neuropsychiatric disorders implicate a dysregulation of several neurotransmitters. If one is affected, this may affect the others or the balance between the neurotransmitters. How GABA specifically acts in the equation is a question for the future. Scientists emphasize that the jury is still out on whether toxoplasma is capable of influencing behavior or mental states of infected people, given the preliminary nature of the studies, showing a tentative link between the parasite and human behavior. We believe that this knowledge may be important for further understanding of complex interactions in some major health issues that modern science still hasn't been able to fully explain. At the same time, it's important to emphasize that humans have lived with this parasite for many, many millennia. So today's carriers of toxoplasma need not be particularly worried. Although, I'm having my cat checked, just to be sure. A little grapefruit juice. Yes, this is grapefruit juice mixed with water on the rocks. Is delicious and healthy. Good for you. We're so glad that you're here with us tonight on X Squared Radio. We're all preparing for the holidays, for Christmas, getting out and shopping for the family members, especially the kids and grandkids. They have excited anticipation, I'm sure. I know when I had four small kids at home, I did all kinds of weird stuff. You know, we set up the Christmas tree and everything, and always we would leave some toys back, like the bicycles and the big dollhouses and stuff, until Christmas Eve. The kids would go to sleep. And one Christmas, we lived in a house that had a fireplace, and so I took one of my boots and some ordinary flour, and I put the flour on the sole of the boots, and I made footprints from the fireplace to the tree. And then, of course, I set the bikes up in the dollhouses and all that. And sure enough, the next morning, I mean, just after sunup, my oldest son, who then was about, I don't know, seven or six, something like that, comes running into the bedroom. Dad, Santa Claus left his footprints and he left me a bike. That was so cool. You gotta just love the job of dad. It's one of the best jobs there is. And I think it's one of the best paying jobs out there. All right. This one's serious. No, really serious. 35,000 rubber ducks have been seized at the border. No, it's true. It's true. You know and I know the danger of rubber ducks trying to get into the country. Well, they may have had better luck on Santa's sleigh, but more than 35,000 holiday-themed rubber ducks from China were detained by U.S. Customs officials at the Port of Los Angeles. It's true. They had not good intentions, these ducks, I'm telling you. U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers seized the ducks, who fortunately did not put up much of a fight. They were dressed as snowmen, gingerbread men, penguins, and reindeer, which were valued at $18,522 after determining that these ducks contained the chemical phthalate in excess of the limit, which may be harmful to children. It's true. Phthalates are used to make vinyl and other plastics soft and flexible, and these ducks are just a little too soft and too flexible, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security said in a statement. Consumer officials prohibit the sale, distribution, and import of any child's toy or child care item that contains concentrations of more than 0.1% of phthalate. In the last 4 years, the U.S. Customer Protection Safety Commission and Customs and Border Protection stopped more than 8.5 million units of about 2,400 different toys and children's products due to safety hazards or failure to meet federal safety standards. Thank goodness for those federal agencies. Just think how terrible it would be for our country if these rubber ducks would have been allowed to hit the streets of America. On the other hand, you know, these guidelines are well known. And so in making these things, which probably cost about a nickel a piece, the manufacturer should know better. Not more than 0.1% of phthalate. I'm sorry if the ducks are just a little too hard, not so squishy and squeaky as rubber ducks are of old. You know, I personally had to get rid of all my rubber ducks just because, well, I just didn't know. This was before the regulations came out, so we trashed them all. It was terrible. Also in the news, and this is something that's been going on for a long, long time, probably, I don't know, a couple thousand years. One thing about humans, mortals, is they always want to live longer, and they want to live a better life longer. You don't just want to be a geriatric forever. Who wants to live to be 140 with a colostomy bag? No offense to those that are out there wearing colostomy bags, but seriously, folks, you know, there's a limit to what you can do. Now, that being said, there's something to be said about being, you know, eternally young and beautiful. I mean, it's nice. 50 is the new 40, right? Or the new 35. Just look at the actresses out there that have been at it for a long, long time. Look at the treatments and things that are available, not the least of which is Cher and others. I mean, my goodness, what did a 60-year-old woman look like 150 years ago? Dead, probably. Well, they probably still are dead, but they look better anyway. There's a new thing out there called the Methuselah Manifesto. Former biotech company founder Robert Bradbury. Now, I don't know if this is the son of famous science fiction novelist Ray Bradbury or not, but it just seems interesting that a biotech company founder would be named Robert Bradbury. He proposed that the accumulation of misrepaired double-strand breaks in the DNA that make up our genes as a significant cause of aging. That's kind of important to know, because you know, when we're young and, you know, we break a bone or we have a contusion, a scratch, a bruise, a cut, whatever, it heals pretty quickly. We get out in the sun, we get sunburn, it heals pretty quickly. The skin is young and it's supple and it's smooth and there's no wrinkles to it, even around the eyes and the mouth, even though we bend it, you know, thousands of times every single day. But as you get old, those kinds of things become less elastic, less resilient, and the wrinkles begin to show up. And the skin is one of the hardest things to take care of because, you know, face it, we're not built for this planet. We don't like the cold. We don't like excessive heat. We don't like a lot of sun. We don't like a lot of salt water. You know, we're just not built for this planet. We have to wear armor. We have to wear clothes. We have to put ointments and oils and creams and things on to protect us from various radiations around our planet. And that's just the way it is. But as we get older, all that wear and tear begins to show up because of these misrepaired double-strand breaks in the DNA. If a single strand is broken, the second strand functions as a template for guiding the proper repair of the broken one. That makes sense, doesn't it? It's a good design. Misrepaired genes make distorted proteins. That's what genes do. Is they make proteins in the body. Proteins make up all the stuff of the body. The lining of the gut, your veins, your bones, your skin, all of the organs and everything are all built of proteins and various other compounds. Proteins are very large, what we call macromolecules. Some of them are very big, 50,000, 10,000, half a million molecular weight. They're complex to build because they're made out of millions of atoms. And the genes are what unfold and recoil up these proteins. And the genes have a variety of proteins that they can make. Depends on the environment. The toxins that you take in, the amount of sunlight you're exposed to, the amount of stress you're exposed to, your own personality and consciousness affects it. The consciousness of those around you affect it. It's true. It affects the timing and hormone balance in your body. All that stuff gets linked up, gets synced, gets entrained with other beings around you. So your environment affects all of this. What happens is that these distorted proteins, which do not work as well, or sometimes they don't work at all, by age 70, each cell averages several thousand double-strand breaks. However, some cells are unscathed by these breaks. It's true, even at 70. Bradbury is developing techniques to identify these pristine stem cells, which he believes may be used to grow new organs and tissues to replace damaged or old ones with your own genetic material. No chance of rejection. He points out that there are some 2,600 stem cell therapy trials currently underway in the U.S. That's a lot. They're well-funded. Why? Because we'd pay for it. I mean, come on. If we could come up with a topical ointment that you could put on the head to regrow hair, you wouldn't be able to cash your first check. It would be so big. Gregory Fay, the chief scientific officer of the 21st Century Medicine, is working on cryopreservation of tissues and organs. Fay points out that about one-third of people die of organ failure, for example, heart attacks, kidney failure, you know, pancreatic, the like. The problem is that the ice crystals that form during freezing damaged organs, it damages the organs a lot. Because, you know, the water swells and the swelling lyses the cells and it can cause a lot of damage to the cells that won't be repaired while they're frozen. And when you thaw them out, well, you just have a big jelly mess. His company has developed a number of low-toxicity cryoprotectants that enable the vitrification of organs as they cool. Vitrification prevents the formation of ice crystals and thus limits freeze damage. Vitrified cornmeal cells transplanted into the eyes of vervet monkeys work. Fay has successfully transplanted a dog kidney kept at 0 degrees Celsius for 4 days. Theoretical biogerontologist Aubrey de Grey, the founder of SENS Foundation and the Methuselah Foundation, is the Energizer Bunny of anti-aging scientific research and advocacy. SENS stands for Strategies for Engineered Negligible Senescence, which DeGray defines as an integrated set of medical techniques designed to restore youthful molecular and cellular structure to aged tissues and organs. DeGray focused on one proposed anti-aging solution, which is to install mitochondrial genes. Those are the haploid genes. Those are the male side of the genes. Mitochondrial genes in the nuclei of cells. One theory of aging is that the cellular powerhouses, the mitochondria, produce highly reactive molecules called free radicals as a side effect of generating energy to run cells. These free radicals over time cause mutations in mitochondrial genes, which become ever more damaged, producing even more free radicals in a downward death spiral. If these mitochondrial genes could be removed to more protected nucleus, this free radical death spiral could be greatly attenuated or slowed down. Engineering this migration from mitochondria to nucleus has been successful for one gene so far. DeGray also addressed the problem of eliminating the damaging cross-linked proteins and sugars that clog cells and damage the extracellular matrix. The SENS Foundation is funding research to find enzymes and bacteria that degrade these organic complexes with the goal of turning them into drugs. Enzymes are also macromolecules. They are kind of specialized molecules that look for specific other molecules or physiological sites like nerve endings or muscle tissue or kidney tissue or liver tissue, and they gravitate toward that, and they're commonly used to deliver all kinds of drugs, including chemotherapy. We take enzymes and we attach buckyballs to them. Buckyballs are like little soccer balls made of carbon atoms. And we stick a large bismuth atom inside the buckyball. It has a very large nucleus. And then we take the enzyme, which is in a solution, and we vacuum it through a tube in a little vial about this big. It goes up over and into a heavy water tank chamber, and it's rotated and exposed to a californium source. Californium, as you know, is a neutron generator, a neutron. It decays and puts off neutrons, radiation. The neutrons stick to the bismuth and load it up. And then that enzyme is quickly transported to the hospital and injected into the patient. Now, those neutrons are only going to stay on the bismuth for an hour or two, and then they're going to come off. The nice thing about attaching the buckyball that has the bismuth atom in it is that the enzyme will carry it to the exact location where the chemotherapy or the radiation therapy needs to be administered. When the neutron comes off, it's an alpha decay. In other words, it's not a gamma decay. It's not a beta decay. It's a big old fat alpha particle, which is an energized neutron. Remember, it came off the californium source, stuck onto the bismuth. Well, when it decays, it comes off and it looks for something dense, something that it's going to collide with. Either that or it's going to sail right outside the body and go into the air. The most dense thing around are either bone or cancer tissue. Cancer tissue is about five times more dense than healthy tissue. So the odds of a neutron, an activated neutron like this, high energy, colliding with a cancerous cell is five times greater than it is a healthy cell. And so when it does that, it kills the cell. And that's how radiation therapy is administered chemically using enzymes. So that's what enzymes are used for. And that's what we're talking about, using complex organics and turning them into drugs that look like enzymes, act like enzymes. So they'll go to specific portions of the body and do specific things instead of attacking the whole body. We don't want that to go everywhere, only to where the bad stuff is, right? Now, one major barrier to cracking the problem of aging is a shortage of researchers. Computer scientist Peter Voss, the founder of Adaptive Artificial Intelligence, aims to solve the researcher shortage by creating the equivalent of thousands of researchers and research assistants by means of artificial general intelligence. Imagine hundreds of thousands of PhD-level machines chipping away at the aging problem, mused Voss. 2 years ago at the Singularity Summit, Voss declared, "In my opinion, AIs will be developed almost immediately in less than 10 years and quite likely in less than 5 years. At the Longevity Summit, Voss predicted that his artificially intelligent researchers will be ready in 6 years. I think they're going to be ready sooner than that. Biology is nanotechnology that works. It's true. I was talking with a biologist just a couple of weeks ago. We were talking actually about biological termination, which is a method of sterilization when you're making medical devices. And the interesting thing about it is, you know, when you start out with molecular biology, you start out with biochemistry, and then you go into biology, you have a different viewpoint of it. You don't think of it in terms of, you know, mitotic and meiotic division and survivability. You think of it in terms of these are living nanotechnological machines, and that's what they really are. So when he enters the room and says, "Are there any biologists in here?" I always say something like, "There's no such thing as biologists anymore. There's only molecular biologists. Everything is down to the molecules now." By the way, nanotechnology means really, really small technology. It was originated by a man named Dr. Kim Drexler. There was a contest out, actually, to see who could build the world's smallest motor. At the time, Bill Clinton was the president of the United States. The contest, the incentive was put out there. And somebody did make a motor that was so small you had to look at it through a, you know, magnification to see it run. Well, Dr. Kim Drexler made a planetary gear. A planetary gear is a central gear with three, four gears on the outside of it, and then a ring gear on the outside, and it's designed to break down torque so that you can spin an inside shaft a lot and make the outside shaft move rather slowly. Well, this planetary gear only took 4,553 sodium atoms to build, and it took an electron microscope to see it run. The film was showed to Al Gore, and Dr. Kim Drexler won the contest. He also combined biology and engineering and created the field of nanotechnology. So, or maybe it was chemistry and engineering, but he was the first one to create the system of nanotechnology. Now, of course, one of the early pioneers in the system came from gaming. That's true. Multimedia, the founder of multimedia, big gamer, big time, you know, Atari, Xbox kind of gamer, not a game player, but a game writer, knew that the kind of software that it would take to generate an assembler would have to come from gaming technology. And so the two blended their minds. And the generation two or three after that was an actual DNA replicator. So that's where that came from. I want to go and finish the story, but I do have a regular caller calls in every week, and I want to get update from California. Rollin, what's going on in California? Welcome.
Well, hi, Brooks. How are you tonight?
We're doing great. Are you watching us on TV?
No, No, I've tried to stay away from the TV lately. I think I'd rather listen to BBS Radio, or I'd rather listen to BBC, PRI, NPR, read newspapers.
If you're listening,
there's a lot of stuff on your TV I don't care to watch.
If you're listening on your computer, you can go to bbsradio.com and click on the link, and you can not only listen to us, but you can see us.
Oh, really? Oh, so you have a video link on there.
Yeah, BBS Radio TV. We're live tonight.
Okay, great. Well, unfortunately, tonight I can't get on the internet because I have no hookup right now with connection. Because the place I'm going does not have an outlet where you can... And my battery's dead in my laptop. So I'll have to pass on it tonight. Is that every week, though?
Yes, and it's going to get even more fantastic as the weeks go on. We're going to make it live and interactive. So if you get video on your phone, we can see what you see live on TV.
Wow. Or how about from a camera on the laptop?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that'll be great. So I'll be implemented soon?
That's going to be implemented very soon, before the end of the year.
Wow, nice. So, out here in California, did you hear about the teachers that have to be retrained because of misconduct?
Misconduct, no. I didn't know. I mean, they're misbehaving in the class, or you think the students are misbehaving in the class?
I don't know exactly what the misconduct by these teachers were. It's probably numerous things. What they've done is they've taken 300 teachers from Los Angeles Unified School District. They put them back in for retraining and testing in a building, and they have to be retrained and tested before they go back into teaching.
Wow. Every single teacher? Because I think we have some really great teachers in California.
300 teachers have to do this.
Oh, I see. I wonder how they identified these teachers. Did it come from student surveys?
I think this was more from administrator surveys. I think it came more from an administration point of view. And for whatever reason, they felt these teachers weren't doing the proper job. So maybe they didn't feel their education levels were up to what they should be to be teaching what they were. So they put them into retraining and retesting.
Well, I wonder how the teachers' union feels about that.
Could be an interesting thing because also they had that port union strike out here in Los Angeles Harbor.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And we just read a story where they seized 35,000 rubber ducks that came in from China, had a little bit too much of one chemical in them.
Wow. So they were going to... poisonous rubber duckies.
Well, I don't know about poisonous. They had more than 0.1% of the monomer called phthalate, which is used to make the vinyl nice and soft. I had to get rid of all my rubber ducks here because I just didn't know what they had in them.
Okay. Also, did you hear about, I believe it was in Georgia and Kentucky, it was a teacher named Clarence Mumford.
I haven't heard of it. Maybe this was the teacher over here in Marion, North Carolina?
Well, this guy evidently, what he was doing was he was taking $1,500 to $3,000 off teachers that wanted to become teachers and getting other people to go in and take their tests for him.
Well, that sounds very enterprising.
Yeah, I guess he made a few bucks off it. If you look up, I think a teacher, I believe it was Kentucky or Georgia, that had people take tests for teachers to pass their tests in order that they could become a teacher. They weren't actually taking it. False identification was given, and then they had other people in there taking these tests for the teachers. Now they don't know where those teachers went, and there's thousands of teachers involved in this.
Wow, before long, there are going to be school administrators, principals. I think that's very enterprising.
Well, you know, I guess this guy was just out to make a buck.
Well, you know, it's the age of entrepreneurs. You know, wherever you see a need, you know, somebody is going to make a product to fill that need.
Exactly. And that's the thing. If there's a need out there, somebody will be enterprising enough to figure out how to make it work.
Isn't that what Mr. Copperbottom said in the movie Robots? See a need, fill a need.
There you go, man. That's it exactly. And other than that, let's see. The governor has asked, obviously, for more immigration, and he wants to give them driver's licenses. And our Attorney General, Pamela Harris, she wants to deport any illegals that have committed crimes and deport them out of California. Our Sheriff, Leroy Baca, only wants to deport the ones that have done worse than a misdemeanor. So you have a county sheriff against the Attorney General of California. So we'll have to see how that rolls out.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it rolls out. I don't know when it comes to illegal aliens what the solution is. I think the ultimate solution is to make it just as easy to get a job in Mexico as it is the U.S.
Right, and have their economy as good for them so that they can get a job in the same way they can get one here and get the same pay.
Well, I know it is getting that way in some areas. I know down in Chihuahua and down near Guatemala City, there are a lot of factories, and now Mexicans are taking great pride in saying, made in Mexico. Some of the best plastics, some of the best printing, some of the best welding, auto interior trim, all that is being made in Mexico, and those plants are doing fine.
Right. I think the people in Mexico have a lot of pride in their work. I think it's just that they had a lot against them over the years.
Well, it's true, and I think most of it has to do with the integrity of the banking system. Not that it's any better here, but at least the perception of it being better here is there.
Banking system. Did you hear about, I think it was last Friday, Citibank laid off 11,000 employees worldwide?
Well, yeah, I heard 3,000 here in the United States, and that's a sure sign that their stock's going to go up. It happens all the time. We do have a banking segment in the next hour, and I'm going to cover it in a lot more detail.
Okay, my understanding was it was 11,000 worldwide, and I guess 3,000 were U.S. employees.
Yeah,
that's right.
That's probably true.
People.
And Citicorp and Morgan Chase are. And even Wells Fargo laid off some people last year right here in Charlotte.
Do they? So I think the banking industry, you know, they're going to have to cut back just like everyone else.
Well, it has to be done cheaper. And I can tell you, I wrote all of the process guides for Wachovia. They hadn't captured any of their human resource processes in writing, and I was tasked to do that. So I wrote all that up. And I trained Indian technicians how to take care of all the HR responsibilities. The rest of it was still done here in the States. But I was surprised that a bank as large and as successful as Wachovia had never written anything down. They had people that were skilled, but no written procedures for how to do what they did. So I wrote all the process guides down, and next thing you know, Wachovia is purchased by Wells Fargo.
Huh. So Wells Fargo purchased Wachovia?
Yes.
Okay, so they're now a conglomerate.
Right. Well, listen, I have a call hold on from Slovenia.
Is it going to be called Wells Fargo?
It's going to be called Wells Fargo. Yeah, yeah. Okay. It is not. It is an amalgamation, but the name that's going to survive is Wells Fargo.
Oh, great. Okay. And by the way, I saw a great friend tonight that I haven't seen her in years, about a year or two. And Carly is a very, very nice girl. She is John, what was his name? the guy who did Three's Company, John Ritter. That's his daughter. Anyway, it was great to see her. I hadn't seen her in a couple of years.
So, oh, wow.
Anyway, she's a wonderful person. Her uncle is David Morgan, the keyboard player, and he was playing tonight. He released the CD. And last night I got to go to a thing that was a event by the Marmalade singer, Dean Ford. And the Marmalades was a band that came out of Scotland about the same time as the Beatles. And the hit song was Reflection of My Life. So I've had a real nice weekend, actually.
Oh, sounds awesome.
So I hope you have a great week, and I hope all these things gel out and they go for the best.
Well, then they will. With that hope, that may be all we need.
Brooks, all we can do is hope, pray, and hope, keep trying to do the best we can.
That's all God can ever ask of us, isn't it?
Pretty much. There's not much more we have. Anyway, sir, you have a great week, and I will try to get on the Internet next week so I can view the show.
Thank you very much. Talk to you later, Roland.
Okay, Brooks. You have a great week.
You too. Bye-bye. I want to go ahead and finish this nanotechnology story off just as we end this hour. The goal of medical nanotechnology is to unleash exceedingly tiny machines, as it were, to patrol throughout the body and its cells, repairing damage as it occurs. They envision respirocytes to carry oxygen more efficiently than red blood cells, microbivores to attack and digest pathogens, and even chromolocytes to repair and replace damaged chromosomes. They're sort of like little tiny man-made viruses that can go in and administer repairs that need to be done. They can deliver drugs. They can deliver genetic material. Hang on a second. Let's see. I want to write this one listener in Slovenia. So she can reach us here. Okay. The way nanotechnology works and the way it's built, it used to be built, it's called mechanochemistry. We used a scanning tunneling microscope, which is like a little tiny phonograph needle vibrating at 100,000 cycles a second. And what we would do is we'd use the needle to kind of push the atoms and the protons around and connect them all together. Well, as you can tell, that's very, very slow. Now what is done is we use a gravure roller. A roller looks something like this. Okay, it looks like this. And we have a laser, and it cuts into the gravure roller, usually made of ceramic or very, very, very smooth steel, a certain pattern. And that pattern has the nanotechnology pattern. And then we mire this into liquid so that we kind of let one edge of this be in liquid, which contains the compound that we're trying to make the nanotechnological shape out of. And then we roll the gravure roller in the mire pan. It soaks up the chemical. It's coated onto film up here. The film comes off with dots on it, which are made up of all the little patterns that came out of the gravure roller. And then those dots are cured somehow, either thermally with infrared or photographically using UV, or dehydrated somehow. Sometimes they're put into a vacuum and sometimes they're just dehydrated. And what you end up with is a teeny tiny nanotechnological shape, just like what was laser cut into the gravure roller. Then the drugs or whatever needs to be put inside that unit or coated on the outside of that unit can be done. Or the little pieces can be assembled, and then it can be injected. Now, these are very, very small, some of them only a few microns in diameter, and that's how it works. That's how nanotechnology is made in large volume and how it's put to work. Now, If you don't live long enough to take advantage of the new longevity treatments coming along in a couple of decades, this life expectancy calculator suggests that there is a 50% chance that a person will live only another 33 years. Kekich, who's one of the researchers, convened in the summit, urged participants to take good care of their health, diet, exercise, supplements, stress management, because they are not gambling on just 15 more years of life. But perhaps 1,500 more years of life. Oh, yeah, I'm not kidding. By the way, there was a report out in the news this week that said that doctors have consensus agreement that diet cannot affect whether or not you get cancer. I want to officially say on this program that that is a bunch of malarkey. That's a bunch of Feldergarb, if you watch Battlestar Galactica. Diet is one of the most important aspects of whether you remain healthy, whether you get cancer, or any kind of disease. Staying healthy, staying the proper weight, staying in shape and tone, and as you get older, you're going to have to exercise more often, maybe lower impact, but you're going to have to exercise more often. If you miss 2 or 3 days, it's like missing 2 or 3 weeks when you're young. So, yes, diet has a lot to do with it. Drink grapefruit juice once a day, plenty of liquids, plenty of exercise. Most likely, you'll almost never get sick, and you'll live a long time. Look at me. By the way, we're in our 8th year here at BBS Radio. We're happy here. We're also giving a shout-out to our friends at Truth Frequency Radio, Chris Geo and his crew. Thank you very much for rebroadcasting X Squared Radio. Tonight, we are now X Squared Radio TV, and we are live. If you've been to BBS Radio live between 8 and 11 tonight, you could have clicked on the link, and you can watch us as well as listen to us. Let's take a quick break. We'll listen to a little of Leonard Cohen, and we'll be right back after this. Don't go away.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played, and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, and the major lift. The baffled king composing hallelujah, hallelujah. truth I didn't come to fool you. And even though it all went wrong, I'll stand before the Lord a song with nothing on my tongue but hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. So glad you could join us. That's Hallelujah. Leonard Cohen wrote it. Jody, Alana, and Morgan sing it. It's one of my favorite versions of it. If you'd like the link, let me know. I'll send it to you. I bought it off iTunes, and I really enjoy the song, and that's why I shared it with you. If you want to be part of X Squared Radio TV tonight, just go to bbsradio.com, click on the link on the front, and you can watch us, well, me that is, me and my multiple personalities, here from east of the Appalachian Mountains. If you want to call in anywhere in North America, the number is 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-413-9537, 530-413-9537. You can also reach us at BBS Radio 2, number 2, BBS Radio 2 on Skype, which some of you are doing right now. And I appreciate your presence all around the world, even Sonia in Slovenia is watching us live on BBS Radio TV. So good to have her on. If she wants to call in, she can do that. That's fine. We still have a lot to go over tonight, and some of it is going to be pretty timely. You know, for, I don't know, 2 or 3 months this year, we have talked about what many are calling the coming crash of 2013. It's just one of those things that, you know, piles up on you as you watch various forces in the government struggle with trying to balance this very weird card game that seems to be going on around the world. We don't really know how to fix it. We don't really know what caused it. And if you really believe that, then you haven't listened to this program enough. We know exactly what causes it. We know exactly how to fix it. And we know exactly what is happening out there right now. I'm going to play a link for you right now because the question comes up, what do you do? What do you do when one of the very few economic analysts to predict the financial crisis would strike in 2007 and 2008 says, and this guy was dead on the money, nobody thought that was coming. Everybody thought the war is going great, everything's going great, the economy's going great, unemployment's what, 4.5%. Who thought the crash was coming in 2007, 2008? Well, a lot of us did. But we didn't say anything about it officially because we knew the housing bubble was being created by legislation that forced the banks, literally forced the banks to loan money to people that had no business borrowing. And eventually it had to come due. I mean, once people stopped making their payments, you know, and it's not because they weren't making money. It's because these people don't have a history of making their payments, and that's just what happens. Well, what do you do when this guy says that another even more catastrophic economic collapse will hit the United States economy in 2013 or 2014. I, for one, listen. So I want to play this for you. This is a real quick audio. It takes about, 5 minutes to play. I think you'll enjoy it. Sit back, listen. Here we go. This is an interview.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lizanne Saunders, Chief Investment Strategist at Charles Schwab. I've talked in the past about how the market, businesses, and investors dislike uncertainty. And while we alleviated one big question mark with the outcome of the election, it did nothing to provide clarity on the bigger uncertainty, which is the so-called fiscal cliff. Now, the term cliff suggests that if we fall off it, it's a steep and immediate plunge. In fact, the fiscal cliff, even if the whole package kicks in at year end, won't be an immediate hit to the economy. The impact of both the tax hikes and the sequestration spending cuts, of course, will be spread out over the year. In addition, President Obama's win suggests that Fed Chair Ben Bernanke keeps his job and likely the Fed's pedal to the metal, which would temper some of the pain of the cliff. In fact, it might be more of a fiscal gradual slope, but that doesn't mean it isn't a very serious issue. And while the impact might not be immediate, there will be psychological effects, some of which we are already seeing in the form of waning business confidence, record high excess corporate cash, weak capital spending, and of course, anemic hiring. Now, I do see some positive offsets via several trends that have developed this year, including housing momentum, manufacturing competitiveness that comes with stronger exports, and domestic energy strength. But we'll likely need at least a partial resolution to the fiscal cliff. That way, what we're subtracting from those positive trends is significantly less than the fiscal cliff drag of 3.5 to 4 percentage points that is the consensus for the magnitude of the full hit to GDP. Thanks for listening.
All right. So now you have someone from Charles Schwab saying, so if you're smart, you'll listen. At least to hear him out. Forbes reported this spring that the ever bearish and independent Schiff is forecasting another economic crisis that will strike at the very heart of the U.S. economy, sweeping through the monetary system itself and precipitating a massive U.S. dollar and treasury bond crisis. His analysis of the underlying economic problem and solution is essentially the same as it was when he predicted the 2007-2008 financial crisis. Again, Schiff has a view on what the problem is. Let's see if I agree with him. He says, we consume more than we produce and we borrow abroad, but we are never going to be able to pay them back. Not only that, Schiff says that when the economic crisis hits, your money might not be safe. While most major banks have passed the Federal Reserve's strenuous stress tests to ensure their viability in the event of another economic catastrophe, Schiff says those tests are predicated on another massive decline in home equity and real estate prices, which was the last bubble to pop, not the next one. The Fed didn't ask the banks to stress test a big drop in the bond market because that's what's coming, and the banks would fail that. Now, I don't know exactly how bonds work, but here's the basics. Let's suppose a state wants to issue bonds in order to create money, print money, to attract a business to come to their state. They would go to the U.S. Treasury and they would say, okay, I'm the governor and we would like $1 billion worth of bonds. And those $1 billion of the bonds will be issued by the Treasury. They would just roll them off the press like this and give them to the state at 0% interest. The state would then sell those bonds to investors. Investors would pay the state approximately 3.5% interest on that. Those bonds are supposed to mature in 10 years and be worth more than what they paid for the bond. Now, if the state has a AAA bond rating, then that's a pretty good buy. But as you know, because Standard & Poor's has downgraded the United States of America one notch, with another notch, which is going to come in the spring, the federal regulations say that no state can have a bond rating that's more than one notch higher than what the federal government has. So if the federal government is, let's say, a AA rating, a state can be a AAA rated state. But if the United States gets knocked down to single A state, no state in the union can maintain a AAA bond rating. By default, the state has to be knocked to a AA bond rating. This means that the bonds become higher risk. And this means that investors will probably, especially if they're pension-grade investors or hedge investors, they're trying to hedge against a loss, they'll sell that bond. They'll sell it because they don't want to take a risk. They want a AAA-rated bond. They want something that's not going to put their investment at risk. And so they sell the bond. Selling the bond drops the value of the bond even further because it continuously gets discounted. When that happens, the bond market collapses. And that's exactly what is about to happen. His solution, Mr. Schiff, this expert economist, the more you delay it, the bigger it will be. So we need to raise interest rates during the recession to confront the inefficiencies. It's not just the unconventional, it's the exact opposite of what most analysts on both sides of the partisan divide would recommend and flies in the face of the Federal Reserve's management of the crisis by frantically holding interest rates down to what is functionally a 0% rate. Now, the only way that the Fed can make this up, of course, is to print money. And that they've been doing. Between $40 and $80 billion a month is rolling off the presses, so to speak, ones and zeros, at the Fed in order to keep the value of the dollar from completely crashing. It's been going on for months, and it cannot go on for much longer. It just cannot. So, Peter Schiff's advice may be unconventional. Oh, and I can see that, you know, raising interest rates makes sense because it would attract investment money or deposits back to the banks. But if you begin to raise interest rates, you begin to make money harder to get. Well, I don't know if it could get any harder to get than it is right now, even though interest rates are lower than they've been in, what, 50 years. If you could get a home loan, if you could get a small business loan, you'd pay a low interest rate. But that money is very hard to get right now because the banks are not letting it go. No bank wants to let it go. So if you raise interest rates, you provide an incentive to the bank to begin to make loans again. If you get the interest rate back up to 4%, 5%, 6%, it sounds like it's higher, but it isn't really higher. It doesn't really impact home mortgages. It doesn't really impact small business loans. But what it does impact is the amount of money the banks can make off the money they're loaning out. Right now, the only thing they're doing with it is trading currencies. In other words, they're buying yen for dollars and then selling the yen and buying euros and then selling the euros and buying yuan and back and forth and back and forth. And they make these micro trades a few dozen times a month, and that's how they make money. That's how the banks make money. The banks are not making money loaning it out because they're not loaning it out. And even if they did, they wouldn't make money because the interest rates are so low. So Schiff is saying raise the interest rates. You as a depositor would like to see that because when you put your money in the bank, you'd like to see something more than a quarter of a percent interest on your money, wouldn't you? Well, all of the people who were 100% wrong back in 08 are saying that everything's okay now. You believe them? I don't. I am telling them that they didn't solve the problem and are making it so much worse. I didn't get lucky. I just understood the problem. I sold my house and all my debt, everything, all my 401k and everything at exactly the right moment. Why? Because I listened. I listened to what logic told me. And I did that. And I'm debt-free today. I don't own a penny to anyone. Owe a penny to anyone. Wouldn't you like to be there? I think you would. That's not the only panic that's out there. You know, a lot of people, and I have them write me from time to time. I sent a newsletter out this week to talk about it again to people. And I had some people write me back and say, look, I make plenty of money, but I'm in debt up to my eyeballs. I can't pay my credit card debts off. I'm just barely making it ahead. I'm looking at months, maybe years before I get enough money to this thing, underneath this thing. My 401k is gone already. It got taken in a divorce or business failure or whatever. It's gone. I understand that. I understand being buried. I understand having to work 40, 50, 80, 120 hours a week just to make ends meet. I understand having to have two incomes come into the house just to be able to make the light bill each month. I understand that. So do you. That is not the way we were built to live. So if you didn't get the newsletter, go to xsquaredradio.com, sign up for the newsletter. I'll send one out to you. I'm trying to get this advice out to people. Am I an economic expert? No, I'm not. I'm a scientist. I study things. I listen to experts and I study things and I weigh things and I say, follow the money. And that's what I'm doing right now. And what I see happening on a national scale by our government is not the way to solve the problem. There is a way, and we're going to cover that later on this hour. Now, everybody knows what's happening the 21st of this month. We don't need to go in that. You read all the books, including mine, and you've been to the conferences, and you listened to the news stories. Well, there is a lot of panic that is spreading around the world because of December 21st, 2012. Fears that the end of the world is nigh have spread across the world with only days until the end of the Mayan calendar, with doomsday mongers predicting a cataclysmic end to the history of the earth. You've heard it right here on this program. We have openly talked about it. Ahead of December 21st, which marks the conclusion of the 5,125-year long count, which you're now also familiar with, on the Mayan calendar, panic buying of candles and essentials has been reported in China and Russia, along with an explosion in sales of survival shelters in America. I know, my own co-author has bought one and buried one out in back of her house. Gun sales, dehydrated food sales, water filters, all the things that I have told you to get together just to prepare for a normal disaster, not necessarily December 21st. In France, believers were preparing to converge on a mountain where they believe aliens will rescue them. This is the scale that this thing has gotten to. So the precise manner of Armageddon remains vague, ranging from a catastrophic celestial collision between Earth and the mythical planet Nibiru, also known as Planet X, a disastrous crash with a comet, or the annihilation of civilization by a giant solar storm. All of these things are written. They've been put in film. They've been grilled into your mind. And you know what? If that's what it takes for you to get a 72-hour get-together, well, good. Get it together. And December 22nd, don't sell it. Don't give it away or throw it away. You're going to need it. In America, Ron Hubbard, a manufacturer of high-tech underground survival shelters, has seen his business explode. I imagine the guy is probably getting rich. We've gone from a 1 month to a one a day, he said. I don't have an opinion on the Mayan calendar, but when astrophysicists come to me, buy my shelters, and tell me to be prepared for solar flares, radiation, EMPs, I'm going underground on the 19th and coming out on the 23rd. It's just in case, you know, anybody's right. Me, I'm going to go out and put my sunglasses on and stare right at the sun. I think it'll be cool. In the French Pyrenees, the mayor of Bougarac, population 179, has attempted to prevent pandemonium by banning UFO watchers and light aircraft from the flat-topped mountain Pic de Bougarac. According to New Age lore, it is an alien garage where extraterrestrials are waiting to abandon Earth, taking a lucky few humans with them. I really love this stuff. It's just, it's too good. Russia saw people in Omuninsk in the Kirov region rushing to buy kerosene and supplies after a newspaper article supposedly written by a Tibetan monk confirmed the end of the world is coming. the city of Novokuznetsk, faced a run on salt. In Barnaul, close to the Altai Mountains, panic buyers snapped up all the torches and thermos flasks. Dmitry Medvedev, the Russian prime minister, even addressed the situation. "I don't believe in the end of the world," before adding somewhat disconcertingly, "at least not this year," as he hurried out to his armored car. I'm kidding, I added that part. In China, which has no history of preoccupation with the end of the world, a wave of paranoia about the apocalypse can be traced to the 2009 Hollywood blockbuster 2012. Come on, I mean, we put it in film, it's got to be true, right? Historical records. You remember the film with John Cusack. It was a smash hit in China as viewers were seduced by a plot that saw the Chinese military building arks to save humanity. I wonder if they're looking for those up in the Himalayas. I think that would be hilarious. Some in China are taking the prospect of Armageddon seriously, with panic buying of candles reported in Sichuan province. That's over on the eastern side in central China. The source of the panic was traced to a post on Sina Weibo, China's version of Twitter, predicting that there will be 3 days of darkness when the apocalypse arrives. One grocery store owner said, "At first, we had no idea why, but when we heard someone muttering about the continuous darkness, then we understood." Shanghai police said scam artists have been convincing pensioners to hand over savings in a last act of charity. Meanwhile, in Mexico, where the ancient Mayan civilization flourished, the end time has been seen as an opportunity. The country has organized hundreds of Maya-themed events, and tourism is expected to have doubled, even tripled this year. Lots of cruise ships, lots of planes coming in, especially around Chichen Itza. I was going to go there myself. I've canceled out. "It can't hide behind the sun forever, and we would have seen it years ago," a NASA scientist said. The space agency also rejected apocalyptic theories about unusual alignments of the planets or that the Earth's magnetic poles could suddenly flip. Conspiracy theorists contend that the space agency is involved in an elaborate cover-up to prevent panic. But David Morrison, and we've had his statement right here on this program, you remember, he said, "At least once a week I get a message from a young person, as young as 11, who says they are ill and are contemplating suicide because of the coming doomsday. I think it's evil for people to propagate rumors on the internet to frighten children." Well, that sounds like something David Morrison would say. This is a guy that just said, "Look, everything's going to be fine. Go back to the mall. You don't have to prepare for anything. Everything's going to be cool." That just sent the wrong message to everybody, David. Mayans themselves reject any notion that the world will end. Pedro Celestino Yaknoj, a Mayan sage, burned seeds and fruits to mark the end of the old calendar at a ceremony in Cuba. He said the 21st is for giving thanks and gratitude, and the 22nd welcomes the new cycle and a new dawn. Doesn't sound very daunting, does it? Doesn't sound like the world's going to come to an end. Doesn't sound like everything's going to come crashing down or that Nibiru is going to poke itself out from behind the sun and cause our oceans to go, 2,000 feet into the sky. However, we do know that Earth, our solar system, is lining up with the galactic plane. We know that that is occurring. We know that the sun has had highly unusual behavior in the last couple of years. We also know that we set, 7,000 heat records this last summer? That's unusual. I mean, a few heat records is okay. Yeah, it gets hot in the summer. Yeah, it gets cold in the winter. But we're breaking all kinds of records in the summer. We're breaking all kinds of records in the winter. Don't you see anything unusual happening? I do. You do. I mean, we're not brain dead. We can see what's going on around us. What is the date today? It's December 9th, December 9th, and it was 74 degrees here today. That's not right. I mean, people were riding their motorcycles around today without jackets. People are wearing shorts to the mall. That's not the weather around here in December. Up in Minneapolis, it's the longest stretch in history ever since there have been people on this continent without snow. Don't you see anything unusual? I do. I see unusual things. You see unusual things. But when we look ahead, sometimes we have to actually look behind. Does that make sense? Well, it does if you read the book Remembering the Future. That's the book I wrote a couple years ago, Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. You want a copy, go to Amazon and buy it, or go to my website, rememberingthefuturebook.com, and pick up a copy. I have practiced a sort of time travel for most of my life. Yes, it does get confusing at times. When I explain an engineering marvel that hasn't been invented yet, or stand around waiting for a bus that isn't due for three more days, okay, that last one's a figure of speech, but you know what I mean. It's like I know what's going to happen, and I'm in position when it does happen. I know what the trends are going to be. It's not because I'm seeing the future. It's because I kind of go to the future, and I experience, and then I come back to the past, which is the present. It has worked for me my whole life, and it's a little confusing at times. It's hard to explain to people, but if you read the book, I think you'll get it. You hear some experts say we should live in the now. Well, we physicists don't really know what that is. I mean, if there was a now as a singular moment in time, we wouldn't be able to tell you how fast it goes or its location. And we like to know one or the other. We know we can't tell both. That's a Heisenberg uncertainty. But we do like to know one or the other. And we just can't figure that out for the term now. When I discovered a long time ago that the entire universe is a creation of consciousness, I began to have this kind of awakening. I mean, it really shocked me awake. I am classically trained, just like most of my peers. I can tell you that a fact is a direct observation. It's something that you directly see, you directly witness, you directly measure. Hopefully you can collect data from it and prove it. But sometimes you can't collect data. You just see it or you just hear it. And that's what happened to me. And it was like, I don't know, like Elle in the movie Contact. You remember when she said, I experienced something and I can't explain it. Well, I've done my best to try to explain that. Well, it's a short way of saying that most of the energy of the universe travels at the speed of light, which brings all distance to zero, and thus the whole thing is just a time singularity. The Big Bang never happened, but a small amount of the universe, about 5% of it, slows down to sublight speed so we can behold it as a third dimension. It's pretty simple, really, once you jump over to the dark side a few times. I mean dark energy, dark matter. I've been teaching for years that dark energy and dark matter are not really dark at all, but instead are super bright matter moving at the speed of light. I maintain that it may very well be the subconscious of the universe. There really was no Big Bang. It's just our consciousness that slowed time down to recreate distance so that we could savor mortality. We could savor a third dimension. Now, why do I put all these thoughts right after talking about the crash of 2013 or the presidential collapse of 2015 or the solar storm of 2018? You haven't seen any of those things yet. It's because we survive them all. We survive all that. We survive the economic crash of 2013. When the presidency comes apart in 2015, we're going to survive that too. And when a solar storm happens in 2018, we have this terrible EMP, our electronic world is turned upside down for a few years, we survive that too. You see, this entire dimension, that is the third dimension, is our creation. We built it. We designed it. It's here because we observed it into existence. It's our observation of energy that collapses the waves into particles that we experience. And we are not alone in this observation. There are sentient beings all over the galaxy and the universe doing what we are doing. And I can tell you from my own thoughts that some are very much more advanced than us in their weaponry, but they have learned no better than we how to restrain themselves. They still have the will to conquer. They still have the desire for challenge. There are communities that have figured out how to grow beyond the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the pride of life. But they don't stay around long. Why? Well, it's not because they're conquered. Some are. But it's because they've completed this dimension. They've learned what they got to learn. They figured out what they got to figure out, and they move on. They go to the next level of glory, the next level of vibration. Some stay behind. Some stay behind. But it's a great question. By the way, this is the only type of universe that can form instability. It's just because of the golden mean, how energy constructively interferes with itself and thus creates stability in what you see as solids in this universe. If it doesn't do that, if it doesn't fall along those lines of resonance, it can't exist here. It just falls apart. It will only exist for a few billionths of a second and it's gone. Our consciousness is integral to the whole equation. If one of us leaves, then the whole thing collapses and it has to be restarted. If you search your soul, you'll see that I speak the truth. And you can argue with it if you want to. You can say that I'm deceived. And some insist on doing so. But that does not change the truth in the slightest. So if we're the creators, then why do we get ourselves as a society so out of balance? How do we end up borrowing ourselves into a point where everybody in the world is in debt? And by the way, if everyone in the world is in debt, who do they owe their money to? You ever figure that out? Huh. Well, why is it that we end up with all the wealth of the entire planet in the hands of a half dozen men while the rest of the world shares 5% of it? That's crazy, isn't it? I mean, well, you see, there's a natural state of balance, and it appears to take some oscillations before it settles down and runs smoothly. The main issue is that the spirit that makes up the human soul, that's this right here. It's a combination of the mortal body and the spirit within. But I want to get back to the question. Why do races that mature beyond the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life, these are the three main shortcomings of humanity, why do they go away so soon? For some, the challenge is getting ready to go to the next level of joy. The Bible says they shall become pillars of heaven to go no more out, which means they're done, they're finished. They don't need to be more anymore, and they go to heaven and they stop the challenge. They go on to the next level of enjoyment. For others, the joy is in actual service. And, of course, you got to have others to serve, and the others are here. So helping others to see and experience the joy they have found is the goal. Now, they didn't have anyone to show them the way, so why do it? If they were good enough to get there without being shown the way on their own, why go back and help others? Because that's the way we are. If we leave, if we die, if we move away, really the only regret we have as beings is that we didn't finish. We didn't say goodbye. We left people behind. We left children and grandchildren without our wisdom and our guidance and our experience. So one of these famous souls was Jesus. He certainly did not need to do anything to improve his personal glory. He was done. He did not need to do this. He came the way back specifically to show us. He came to show us our divinity. In fact, he never said a word about his own divinity. The idea was to show us that from the raw materials of this planet, we can make our bodies and all the things that make it comfortable if we apply ourselves. We can also convert our bodies back to light from whence we came, but with a twist. They will be physical light bodies capable of amazing things that we cannot even imagine. This earth, this life, is heaven, actually. The cold, the sickness, and the depravity of raw life are the challenges that we crave as beings. The very best leaders and the most kind and blessing of souls mostly come from abject poverty. We are not really natural nor comfortable with wealth and opulence. It is a cancer to our souls. Now, does that mean we should aspire to poverty? Hardly. That's not what I'm saying. It simply means that there's more to life than stuffing our bodies with cake and our warehouses with more than we need. In fact, it means that the economy of mortal life should not be a contest to see how much wealth we can accumulate. It should be a challenge to see how much we can accomplish for the planet or for the human race as a whole in one lifetime. Now, here's the good news. Our race, the contest here on this earth, doesn't start at zero. It could start where you left off in your last mortality, whether it was here or on another world or another dimension. The tough part is remembering who you are. I used to tell my kids before they went to school or out with friends, remember who you are. Does that mean an Agnew? Well, yes, that's certainly a noble clan, but more than that, remember why you came here and why I got to be your dad and what greatness you can do this day. So when I ask you to love as hard as you can or to reach out and find the good in another and to help it to grow every day, I mean it. Inside every body is a spirit that has some goodness in it. Sometimes to have to let that spirit do bad things it designs to do. When a boss fires you, smile at him like you have a safe full of money at home. When your spouse leaves you or abuses you, you don't have to take it, but you also don't have to psychically attack that person the rest of your days. When the economy collapses and seems to enrich that same half dozen men again and again, walk into the next day with a fresh attitude and will to rebuild again by placing your dreams into the future and letting them resonate with the universe. Do you think money is the way to success? I busted that a decade ago. Money might be the result of success, but the success is built with consciousness, not money. That's why the crash is only for those who don't see it coming. But you do see it coming. I told you about it. Others have told you about it. I mean, well, actually, you hear it coming because I'm telling you about it right now, but you are going to stay on the tracks, or are you going to step off the tracks and watch the train wreck a few miles down the road? Well, good. Now, here's what you have to do. There are three basic things. We've talked about them already on this program. We've talked about them in the book. You can see other countries doing it as we speak. I recommend selling your 401k. I'm not the only one. Ann Barnhart says the same thing, and she's a great economist. Call it a hardship. Take the 10% tax penalty and sell it now. If you don't, it will be worth about 30% of what it's worth right now. And actually, it may be worth the same, but the dollar is going to be worth a lot less. You could cash out now, and you can move those dollars to the future, where the dollar is worth three times what it's worth today. It's called a depression or a heavy recession. Prices will drop like a lead balloon, which means your money will be able to buy much more. China is very much closer to ceasing the purchase of U.S. securities for the fear of bankruptcy, which is as certain as rain. It's gonna happen. The economic designers that built the Federal Reserve made it that way, and there's no getting around that. They built it. It's their system. It's going to happen. They want it to happen. It's designed to happen. They do it every so often. They inflate and then collapse the money supply. And if you can do that, you can control the world. It's simple. They've been doing it for 100 years, longer than that. And the central bank has the power right now, and they're heavy after it, inflating the money supply as fast as they can run the presses, as fast as the ones and zeros can pile up in the computer. And when they get the money supply inflated to where they want it, they are very carefully backing out of the market, doing exactly what I'm telling you to do. They're selling their 401k. They're cashing out. They're banking up their cash. They're banking up their silver and their gold. And when they collapse the money supply, that means what does cost $100,000 today will cost $100. And if you have a pile of money and silver and gold, you could buy a planet. And that's exactly what they plan on doing. So the next step is to take your cash out of the banks. It is only insured to a small amount if and only if you are not tied to a money market. And by the way, if you have a free checking account, it's tied to a money market. You lose it all when the bank closes. So take it home with you. It's your money. You take it home with you. Only leave in the bank what you absolutely have to cover the automatic drafts that come out of your account if you have those. Insurance, different kinds of payments here and there that come automatically out of your account. You need to leave that money in there and make your obligations good. Take the rest of it home. And believe me, cash is not biodegradable. You don't have to drive down the highway slipping $20, $50, and $100 bills out the window on the freeway. That's what most of us do when we get cash in our hands. Be smart. Take your cash home and make it safe. The next thing to do is to put basic food and water supply together. Now, realistically, you really need a year's supply of food. But you can't do that. You can't do that. If you can't go out and buy it, don't borrow money to buy it, okay? Just don't. Get yourself a 72-hour kit first, then a week supply, then a month supply. Work on it slowly. I recommend either going to the Food Investor, which is at X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com. Click on that. That's a lightweight 30-year food supply you can take with you, but it's more expensive than what you're going to buy in the store. In the store, buy canned goods, tuna, turkey, canned hamburger patties, soups, noodles, rice, beans, those kinds of things. Store that stuff. You can store it in your garage. You can store it in your basement. You can store it in your pantry. Some of it will keep for 10 years without touching it. I recommend rotating it through your regular meal and store that stuff that you eat. And I don't mean going out and buying a year's supply worth of potato chips or corn chips. You can do it if you want, but I don't recommend it. I recommend canned goods, peanut butter, soups, canned meat patties, canned turkey breasts, that kind of stuff, because it'll last a long time. And when you run out of money, which is going to happen if you lose your job, it's going to happen if there's a power outage, it's going to happen if there's a solar flare, it's going to happen if there's a tsunami or an earthquake or an economic crash, you got to eat. You got to eat. And the FEMA is not going to take care of you. Don't think that the Federal Emergency Management Administration is going to show up with cookies and cocoa and a blanket for you. It isn't going to happen. You need to take care of yourself. You don't want to end up in a camp somewhere herded like cattle because you're having a hard time taking care of yourself. You want to be able to put that together and you want to be able to take care of yourself. So do that. Just do those three basic things. If you live in a city, make plans to go to the countryside with family if a crash like this happens. If you don't have family in the countryside, don't worry about it. You can disappear more easily in the city than you can in the country. If you're going to pull out of the system, two things will happen to you. First, you will be at peace for the first time in your life. You will feel free from debt and overhead and bill collectors, and you'll be surprised on how little you can live on. Second, you'll be able to see the earth again. Remember you lost sight of it. You might even remember why you came here. It will be like coming off a grand drug that has kept you tugging at the harness your whole life. Everyone around you will feel the lack of stress in you. You will change the world because you will see the world in a whole new light. Time, once again, will slow down for you, and your love will be even more amazing. Now, let's talk about this power that we have to convert this Earth into a planet far more enlightened than the one we wake up to every day right now. It's in our control. Can you do it by yourself? Well, you probably could, but it might take 2,000 years. If you could multiply yourself, if you could convince a friend, like I'm trying to do right now on X Squared Radio Live on the BBS Radio Network and on the Truth Frequency Network, you could have a much larger effect. We have this power as individuals. It may be more of an observation rather than an actual transformation. In other words, we can love and look upon every trial as a wonderful experience, and in that sense, the world has changed. That's why two people in the same house can have two completely different worlds, one heaven and one hell. To really transform a world takes a wave of consciousness, propelled by the will of many souls. Still, it only takes a few to make the wave begin. That's what we're doing right here, right now. We're balling up the vision in our hands, and we're getting ready to roll it down the hill of the universe to see if it will gain size and momentum and bowl through the obstacle pins set up by the elite who bask in sunshine and opulence on the backs of the poor, who slave at workbenches until they die an ignominious death. Well, should we all be rich like that? Perhaps not. The vast majority of people never learn how to focus the lens of their brains to allow their consciousness to see beyond the next meal or the next paycheck. The ability to plan a future is beyond all but a very small number of people. You'd be surprised how many people come up to me with a great energy, speaking about the beauties of the things we are discussing here, only to, after a very few minutes of being left to ramble, decay into a much more energetic desire for money and for wealth. It happens all the time. Very, very few people do I sit and have a conversation with, and they actually get it. They actually understand that they don't have to have a big home. They don't have to have a view of the beach and a grand piano in their living room. They don't have to have a Ferrari or a Tesla for each day of the week and a private plane so they can fly around and tell everyone how wonderful it is to be alive on this planet. You get the picture. Kind of makes you want to vomit, doesn't it? It happens every single day. I hear the same stories. So where do we go with this? How do we get past this seemingly insurmountable barrier of pride to get to the true glory of humanity? Well, I didn't make this up. I didn't make any of this up. The masters told us exactly how to do this. We give up our lust for wealth, and we focus on helping others to see their own potential. Now, notice that I did not say, give up your wealth. That's nonsense. That's crap. Jesus only asked the rich man to sell all he had and give to the poor and follow him to test to see if he would do it. And he clearly showed he loved his wealthy life more than the momentary flush inside of him as the pure oxygen of spirituality was dumped upon the light of Christ within him. I said to give up your lust for wealth. Wealth will be yours beyond your will to spend it. I can tell you that. But your lust for it will go away. The fear you feel when you lust after it will go away. It cannot be taken from you because it flows from the bounty of the universe with a passion that cannot be denied. Even lusting for that day will bring you down. It really is not complex once you think about it. The first order of business is to reclaim your own future. Nearly everyone on earth has abdicated their own future to someone else. I think it is time you take back your own sovereignty. Take it back from your spouse. Take it back from your boss. Take it back from your government. It's yours. It sounds hard, and I suppose on a mother-in-law level, it is very hard. Mortals have expectations for you, and you have done a great job with that responsibility and duty. There is, however, the plan of those half-dozen men to crumble the sandcastle and shove us all to the floor again. If you are a sovereign, if you are a sovereign being, and you're clear of the banking cabal, as I asked you to be, then you can fly free of the tree when it is felled and cut up into timber to build the next 40-year empire for them. If you're free of this, you can determine your own future, and the wealth of the universe is yours to enjoy. Let's take a quick break. We'll listen to a little Queen. It's late. You know how much I like that song. It's cool. Be right back. Don't go away.
See if you see. suspicion in your eyes.
Welcome back, my friends, to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. I'm so glad that you're able to join us tonight. It means so much to me. We've been on the air now for nearly 8 years with BBS Radio, and my good friends at Truth Frequency Radio have been rebroadcasting our program. I think they're going to duck out now. They can do it for 2 hours. It's been a great year. I can tell you, we've come a long way with our electric vehicle research. I have enjoyed the sales of Alienated Nation. It went to number one on Amazon. Thank you very much for that. Last year, of course, I published Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. And my good friend Sonia writes me from Slovenia and says how much it influenced her life, and I'm just humbled to the dust for that. I can't tell you. My good friend Drun Vilomelkezedek taught me how to do the meditation. My other good friend Maureen St. Germain, who was a master teacher, taught me the next two levels, and we've traveled around the world together and learned a lot, and I learned a lot from her. I don't know if she learned anything from me, but it's been a great experience, and if I can share that with you in the least, and it, you know, changes your life and helps you at all, then that's good too. We have a lot more to go over tonight, but I want to let you know, if you're going to buy a Christmas gift this year, you might want to do something really unique instead of investing in, say, electronic devices. You might want to invest in something that would really help your loved ones through a rough time if they have one this next year. Invest in food. I know that sounds kind of weird. You can't really send somebody groceries or send them a gift certificate, Kroger or Food Lion or Harris Teeter or Vons or whatever. But I make it easy for you because you can go to x2-radio.com. That's my website, X Squared Radio. And you can go right to the top of the affiliates list, my number one affiliate. And you can visit the Food Investor. My good friends, Danny and Scott out in Utah, have really invented a great process that doesn't use any preservatives. They prepare a delicious food in packages that will allow it to keep for 30 years. So it's a set it and forget it food. If you really want to send your loved ones something that will help them in a rough time, send them a 72-hour kit or a week's supply of food from the Food Investor. Now that's something that they'll remember forever. Take care of that. If you want to be part of the program, you can do so by calling us anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, or anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-413-9537. You can also get to us by going to BBS Radio 2 on Skype. You'll have to make the request, and the folks at the studio will have to add you, but I think there's a way to do it. And we do have people in foreign countries that would like to call in. That's a good free way to do it. A lot going on. One of the things that I've noticed, at least in my lifetime, is that aging has kind of stopped. I saw my friend Nick Begich about 3 weeks ago in Holland, and I was so amazed because he's just a little bit younger than I am, but he looks way younger than the last time I saw him. Just amazing. And it's not just the freedom of stress in his life. Something he's doing is really making him look younger. And, you know, people say the same thing about me and about the people that I know. It's not a unique phenomenon. It's like people are taking better care of themselves. It's like this whole neural network has allowed us to come back into communication with one another and share our feelings and our thoughts and our loves with one another, and people are reconnecting. And I think it's helping us become younger. But there are other things going on. You know, there are animals on the face of the earth that, well, they may be timeless. For instance, back in 2010, there was a jellyfish that was discovered. I just want to share the article with you really fast. Despite science's best efforts to understand and prevent aging, it turns out that a simple jellyfish species, Turritopsis nutricula, has it figured out for millions of years, appearing as a dime-sized parachute. Turritopsis nutricula, or the immortal jellyfish, is able to revert back to its immature polyp state after reaching sexual maturity in response to adverse conditions, indefinitely. It is the only known metazoan, that's a multicellular organism, capable of doing this through a process called cell transdifferentiation. Hydras are also known to avoid senescence, but they do not have the unique ability to reverse their life cycle repeatedly, as this particular jellyfish does. This jellyfish body, or umbrella, first inverts itself, followed by resorption of the tentacles and mesoglea. The inverted jellyfish affixes itself to a hard substance at the opposite end of the umbrella, forms a peristarch sheet and stolons, then produces new polyps to form the basis for a new colony. These new polyps can recycle the process and grow more stolons and give rise to even more polyps to create a fully fledged hydroid colony. Of course, this is only theoretical longevity. In reality, most of these jellyfish die from predation or disease. They're eaten or they get sick. Lately, however, the jellyfish population has soared. Whether this is simply due to their recent discovery or a reduction in the normal causes of death, this is unclear. Moreover, their range has increased because of their introduction to new territories from discharged ballast water, it's warmer water, thereby swarming beyond their native Caribbean regions. Some areas off the coast of California, Japan, other countries, they use nuclear power plants or coal-fired power plants, and they discharge the cooling water, which is now warmed by several tens of degrees, out into the water, creating a warmer state, and that's what allows the jellyfish to bloom. Jellyfish aside, the real cool concept behind this is called cell transdifferentiation. When a non-stem cell transforms itself into a different type of cell, it means a skin cell converting itself to bone, or a epithelial cell and lining of the mouth or the lining of the intestines or colon differentiates to create some other kind of cell that's needed. Cell transdifferentiation is a rare event in both nature and in the laboratory, but it does occur. For example, during fetal development of oesophagus in humans, pigs, cats, horses, and dogs. In fact, Barrett's metaplasia arises from maladaptive transdifferentiation event in which epithelial cells, that's the cells on the inside of the mouth, kind of a flat cell like your hand, very fast growing, very easy to heal. You know, if you get a cut on the inside of your mouth or have a tooth pulled or something, epithelial cells heal amazingly fast. Anyway, they switched to intestinal mucin-creating goblet cells. Adults suffering from this condition are susceptible to adenocarcinomas, which are basically cancers inside the colon, with an 80% mortality rate. Why so high? Well, I told you, epithelial cells grow really, really fast, and cancerous epithelial cells grow even faster. Okay? It's if I could remember the name, it's been a while since I took medical terminology. I do have a degree in biology, but it's hard for me to remember. Squamous cell carcinoma, that's what it is. I knew it was back there somewhere. Squamous cell carcinoma, it's very fast, and it differentiates pretty quickly. And that means it metastasizes rather quickly, usually ends up in lymph nodes. And you get a lymph node here on your neck or somewhere on the body, under the arm or something that swells up. It's because these squamous cells have metastasized and are now in the lymph nodes. And, well, you have to catch it pretty quick because it's very, very fast. That's why it has an 80% mortality rate. In addition, cystis glandularis is another metaplastic transformation pertaining to mucosal cells lining the bladder. Experiments where salamander and chicken lens cells are removed found that iris cells would switch type and regrow as replacement lens cells. A better understanding of the mechanisms behind transdifferentiation has beneficial implications for society at large, even from more successful transplants to controlling diabetes. Also, limb replacement, also skin replenishment, things like that. So lots of cool technology out there with it. And the problem is that in humans anyway, in most mammals, cells don't differentiate very well unless they're stem cells. Stem cell is, as you can imagine, the root cell. It can become anything that it wants to. And normally these cells are in very high concentration in, unfortunately, fetuses. And that's why it's so tempting for labs around the country, because of the incredible amount of money that's behind it, to harvest fetal stem cells, which, as you might understand, would mean harvesting fetuses, which is not very moral at all. You're basically growing partial human beings and then harvesting them in a blender, you know, to get their stem cells. So there are places that you can get these. Excuse me, I got hiccups. You can get these cells in a normal human because we do have adult stem cells. They're more difficult to get. They're best served if you can get them from the adult that needs the differentiation. But it's difficult to do, and science is coming a long way with it. But the FDA in this country really is hampering the research, so it's being done more in other countries, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. I want to try to keep my stories in order here because I have a story here about gold and silver. It's important because this is happening around us, and my friends down at APMEX, that's APMEX, APMEX, I don't get a commission from them. I don't have a link on my website. That's just where I buy my silver. Right now it's up to $37. It was $34 back when I told you to buy it. Many people think that it'll go to $100, maybe more. It's a great place to store your money, and it's a cheap thing that you can acquire, maybe one a paycheck or two a paycheck. By the end of the year, you'll have 50 ounces or 100 ounces. It's a smart idea. It's a smart idea. It's called a hedge. The big investors do it, the hedge against inflation and against losses in more speculative investments. You can do it as a private investor. Just put 1 ounce or 5 ounce or 10 ounce silver bars together, and you can protect yourself from the loss of the money supply. Right now, Russia is stockpiling gold. I can't imagine it means anything cheerful that Vladimir Putin, the Russian czar, he's not really a czar, he's the president, but he's also probably the richest, most powerful man in the world right now. He's stockpiling gold as fast as he can get his hands on it. According to the World Gold Council, Russia has more than doubled its gold reserves in the past 5 years. Putin has taken advantage of the financial crisis to build the world's fifth biggest gold pile in a handful of years and is buying about $500 million worth every month. It emerged last month that financial gurus George Soros and John Paulson had also increased their bullion exposure. But it's Putin that really caught my eye. No one else in the world plays global power politics as ruthlessly as Russia's chilling strongman, the man who effectively stole a Super Bowl ring from Bob Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, when they met in Russia some years ago. Putin's moves may matter to your finances because there are two ways to look at gold. On the one hand, it's an investment that by most modern standards seems to make no sense. It generates no cash flow. It serves no practical purpose. Warren Buffett has pointed out that we dig it out of one hole in the ground only to put it into another. And anyone watching this from Mars would be very confused indeed. You can forget claims that it's real money. There's no such thing. Money is an accounting device, a way of keeping track of how much each of us produces and consumes. It's a promise to pay. It's a contract to pay. It's backed by the faith and credit of the country that issues it. Gold is a shiny and somewhat tacky-looking metal that is malleable, durable, and heavy. It's also rare. A recent research paper by Duke University's Campbell Harvey and co-author Claude Erb raised serious questions about most of the arguments in favor of gold as an investment. But there is another way to look at gold. As the most liquid reserve in times of turmoil or worse, the big story of our era is not that the Spanish government is broke, nor is it that Paul Ryan apparently feels the need to embellish his running record. It's that the United States, which has dominated the world's economy for several lifetimes, is in relative decline. That much is a fact. As was first reported here on X Squared Radio a long time ago, according to International Monetary Fund calculations, the U.S. is on track to lose its status as the world's biggest economy when measured in real purchasing power to China. And that's coming. 2017 or less. It's now 2012. We're talking about less than 5 years. China will be the world's biggest economy. No doubt about it. We will soon be the first people in 200 years to live in a world not dominated by either Pax Americana or Pax Britannica. This sort of changing of the guard has never been peaceful. The declines of the Spanish, French, and British empires were all accompanied by major conflict. The decline of British hegemony was a leading cause of the First and Second World Wars. What will happen as the U.S. loses its preeminence? Tough to say. Maybe this will turn out better than similar episodes in the past. Maybe the Chinese will embrace an open society and the rule of law. But if you believe that, there's probably no reason to buy any gold now, is there? It's just something to think about. Gold for most of us is out of your reach. You can't afford $1,800, $1,900 an ounce. You can't buy half ounces. That's ridiculous. Silver is within your reach. You can do it. You can protect yourself. There's a lot less silver than there is gold. We've consumed 90% of the silver that's been mined in industrial and coinage. And if you're going to own 99.99% pure silver, I guess now is as good a time as any to have some. So what's going on with it? Why is it being manipulated? Is it being manipulated? That's a good question. JP Morgan is short silver and gold. No doubt about it. This is a very different approach from all other talk of manipulation, but if true, would go a long way toward explaining why some of the clearinghouses may be trapped into large short positions on gold and silver. And if you agree with this, I urge you to write the CFTC. There are valid arguments to not limit positions. When large hedge funds or even countries want to buy or sell in large quantities, there needs to be a potential offset trader to provide a counterpoint and liquidity. Otherwise, the markets would become very chaotic. Now, having said this, it's hard to believe that the large clearinghouse shorts would have maintained their positions if they had had to put a margin and mark to market their own positions. It just wouldn't happen. The net margin concept for clearinghouses is based on the idealistic expectation that they do not take a position themselves and that they serve the function of being an unbiased and neutral clearinghouse for buyers and sellers. That's not happening. JP Morgan is one of the largest vaults of silver in the world. They are long on silver at the same time that they're holding short positions. If the CFTC can change the rule to require that all parties post margin on their own position and mark these to market, I doubt very much that we would see the shenanigans or huge positions that we currently see. It's sort of like naked shorting, but with metal. This also goes a long way to preserving the integrity of the market, as genuine buyers and sellers would know that their positions would not be at risk because the holder of the short, the company that you're buying the short position with, is not the one that owns the silver. And that's what's happening at JP Morgan. That's why it's so dangerous. If it makes the price of silver go up and you own some, it could work in your favor. Now, I wanted to get into this in the last hour. I'm going to have Dr. Hilde on next week on the program. And she has been talking with Tom Horn and others about the advent of what is termed transhumanism. We on this program, we call it para-human. A para-human. I'm human. A para-human is someone that has some enhancement to their body. And I'm not talking about just steroids. I'm talking about genetic enhancement. Okay? Transhumanists advocate the improvement of the human's capacity. Remember, we used to talk about eugenics. Eugenics was the elimination of weak gene strains from the human race. You know, the retarded, the slow, the poverty-stricken people, foreigners, blah, blah, blah. You go on and on and on. If you want to know about it, you don't need to read it from me. You can read it from Margaret Sanger. Margaret Sanger is the founder of Planned Parenthood. If you read her diary, you read her manifesto for setting up Planned Parenthood in the first place. It was to systematically kill the babies of those races and individuals that she no longer wanted to exist in this country. That was called eugenics. She's the master of it. She's the one that brought it from World War II to here, to this country. It's the foundation of Planned Parenthood. That's why Planned Parenthood does abortions. If you want to learn more about it, you can read the book Alienated Nation, and you can find out about it for yourself. You want to know more about that specific subject, you can read a book called The Silent Scream, and you can learn about it. Well, we're not just talking about technology, as in gadgets you might get from Best Buy, but technology in the grander sense of strategies for eliminating disease, providing cheap but high-quality products to the world's poorest, improving quality of life and social interconnectedness, and so on. Technology we don't notice because it's blended in with the fabric of the world. transhumanists tend to take it much further than that, a longer view of that. We realize that the longer you look forward, the more uncertain the predictions get. But one thing is quite certain. If a technology is physically possible and obviously useful, human ingenuity will see to it that it gets built eventually. That's what I'm saying. No amount of regulations is going to keep our electric vehicles off the road. Can't happen. Why? Because we have tens of thousands of customers that want our vehicles. It can't happen. If people want the vehicles, we will build them and they will buy them and drive them. As we gain even greater control over the atomic structure of matter, and we're getting there, believe me, our technological goals become increasingly ambitious and their payoffs more and more generous. Gene therapy. I know you know what this is. We're using it already in the medical field in a lot of areas. It replaces bad genes with good genes. And RNA interference can selectively knock out gene expression. Together, they give us an unprecedented ability to manipulate our own genetic code by knocking out genes that code for certain metabolic proteins. Scientists have been able to make mice that stay slim no matter how much junk food they eat. You know people like this. We hate them. Lou Gehrig's disease has been cured in mice, and it could be only a few years before we develop a therapy that can cure it for humans too. Like many transhumanist technologies, gene therapy is really exciting because it's only the beginning. And we're not talking about just human genes here. No scientist has yet performed gene therapy on germline cells. These are sexual cells in the actual gonads themselves, okay? The haploid cells in the testes and the egg. Due to the ethical controversy of producing genetic changes, which are heritable, okay? But as with many of these, it's only a matter of time. Regulations in any given country will be capable of slowing the overall progress of the field by a few years at most, because some countries don't have those regulations. And I can tell you that if our enemies are doing it, we're going to be doing it. The money will go where the research is permitted. You know that. In its mature form, gene therapy and genetic engineering will become extremely cheap and powerful, letting humans live comfortably in a wider range of environments and gain immunity to most, if not all, diseases, including viruses. You know, we can't cure a single solitary virus, not one, not even the cold. We can vaccinate against it. We can prevent ourselves from getting it, but we don't know how to cure it. Some animals can do it. We cannot. Supercomputers of the future with thousands or millions of times the crunch power of today's best will let us simulate the changes in extreme detail before we attempt them with the actual human being. This will make ill side effects quite unlikely for the typical case. That is to say, if you put all the parameters into the program. Michael Chorost is a man who was born almost deaf, but now he can hear, thanks to a cochlear implant. Rush Limbaugh, same way, lost his hearing from these and from hearing disease. And now he wears cochlear implants. Most of the cyborgs in fiction fit certain stereotypes. Cyborgs already walk among us, and they look like just normal people. Cyborg legs, cyborg arms, cyborg eyes, cyborg ears, cyborg hearts. This trend will continue in the future, but that's not what I'm talking about. This is a process of cyborgization, and it's been happening for centuries, if not millennia. Well, there's more to it than that. There's a new term out. I'm going to play this audio for you. I think it'll bring you up to speed. It's about 5 minutes. Let me get this out of the way, and then you'll understand. British scientists have created more than 150 human-animal hybrid embryos in British laboratories. The hybrids have been produced in secret over the past 3 years by researchers looking into the possible cures for wide ranges of diseases. The revelation comes a day after a committee of scientists warned of a nightmare planet of apes scenario in which work on human-animal creations goes too far. Last night, a campaigner against the excesses of medical research said he was disgusted that scientists were dabbling in the grotesque. Let's listen in.
Plans to allow scientists to create embryos that are part human and part animal are set for approval by the official regulator in Britain. These hybrid embryos are seen by the country's leading scientists as a vital step in the search for cures for diseases such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. It's a highly controversial procedure and is banned in some European countries. Our medical correspondent Fergus Walsh has the story.
This embryo is part mouse, part cow. In a few months, this Newcastle lab is hoping to create a human-cow hybrid. If that leaves you uneasy, the scientists here understand how you feel.
It does seem a little abhorrent from first analysis, that the fact that we're mixing cow bits of cow cells with bits of human cells, and people would automatically think, yeah, well, okay. But what you have to understand is that we're actually using very, very little information from the cow in order to do this reprogramming idea.
This is highly complex science, the creation of cytoplasmic hybrids, known as cybrid embryos. The starting point is a cow's egg, which is cut open by a laser. The DNA is sucked out. The next step is to take a human cell, perhaps from a patient with Parkinson's disease, and inject it into the egg. Now, this is the crucial point at which an embryo is created, because by using an electric shock, the hybrid embryo starts growing, the cells subdividing. In reality, it's smaller than a pinhead, and when it's just 6 days old, the embryo shell is broken open. Inside are stem cells, the body's master cells. The ultimate aim is to reprogram them into any tissue in the body, for example, nerve cells, heart cells, or brain cells. If it wasn't for the cocktail of pills he takes every few hours, Frank Brooks could barely walk. He has Parkinson's disease, the degenerative brain disorder, and strongly supports the new research.
It would be an enormous benefit if that cure was developed to the people who are young enough to benefit from it, because it's going to be a few years before it's here. But if we don't start now, we're never going to get there.
Approval for this research is a victory for scientists, as ministers originally planned to ban hybrid embryos. But religious and moral opponents are worried.
I think this is a further violation of the rights of the embryo, in that the embryo is deprived not only of its life in the course of the experiment, but of any human parents. It is further dehumanized by the very method of its creation.
Scientists say this research is of profound importance and could lead to new treatments for a host of diseases like diabetes and Alzheimer's. But all this is years away. The science is just beginning. Fergus Walsh, BBC News.
And I'll be back to look at how the public might respond to this complicated procedure in the politics.
Well, I want to cover that myself. So that's the gist of it. You basically have doctors who are taking human DNA and they're combining with animal DNA. Right now they're doing it in the animal. Now, why have they kept this secret? If they're proud of what they're doing, why do we need to ask parliamentary questions for this to come to light? The problem with many scientists is that they want to do things because they want to experiment. And that is not a good enough rationale sometimes. Last week, a group of scientists called for new rules to prevent lab animals from being given human attributes, for example, by injecting human stem cells into the brains of primates. Now, there are several reasons for which parahumans, or these chimeras, might be created. The current forms of chimera exist for medical and industrial purposes, for example, the production of drugs and organs for suitable for organ transplantation. If we're talking about ears and heart valves and livers and things like that. Other experiments aim to reveal knowledge about the function of the human body by creating mice with a human-like immune system to study AIDS, or with a brain incorporating human nerve cells. Restriction on cloning and stem cell research have made chimera research an attractive alternative. Now, if a line of parahumans could be created using germline engineering, if they also bred true, and if they were different enough from ordinary humans to be unable to breed with us, then they would qualify as a species by themselves. Parahumans created using only somatic genetic engineering would have human children. Another key difference is that a germline parahuman would have to be modified before birth, while a somatic parahuman could be an adult human who chooses to be modified. Which one is more ethical is a matter of debate. At least the one that's adult gets to choose. The one that's unborn doesn't get to choose. There's something to be said for that. But as I said, if our enemies are doing it, then we're going to do it. There's no question about it. An argument for this is that no harm is done to a person born with modified genes because the person would have no idea, no control over their genes in the first place. An argument for the latter argument, being more ethical, is that the changes would be made with informed consent, as I said. So, if the powers reflected in Charles Fort's book, which is called Godlike, Wild Talents, he calls them, I suppose what we are seeing now could be called talents. Perhaps this is not an example of a whole new array of human capabilities, but simply the honing of some inherent and secret human skill, which is just now coming to light. By the way, that was written in 1940. No one knows how talent powers work. Seems simple enough. We use the word all the time. Somehow, the people who possess them just seem to be able to do the impossible. Flying talents don't require wings or even a source of propulsion to take to the air. Hyper-strong talents don't need to be rippling with muscles to lift a truck. Bulletproof talents don't have rock-hard skin, but the bullets bounce off anyway. In fact, most every single talent looks completely human. They have no discernible features, marks, or anatomical differences that would set them apart from humanity. And yet they can run at superhuman speeds. They can hold their breath for superhuman times. They can think superhuman speeds. This makes them very effective weapons in guerrilla warfare, espionage, and insurgency campaigns. It's hard for the enemy to confiscate a weapon if it's hidden in your mind. And the mind seems to be the crux of the talent phenomenon. There seems to be some link between morale, self-will, and the activation of talent powers. Self-belief seems to fuel a talent's paranormal abilities. Disappointment, depression, defeat, or bad news can cause talent powers to fail. Again, no one has any idea why. The term talent, in the countries of the Allied nations during World War II, the term talent is used to describe anyone with paranormal abilities. In other words, in other countries and cultures, parahumans are sometimes called by different names. Although the talent remains a popular term, even in non-English speaking countries, French superhumans are often called surhommes, supermen. British superhumans are sometimes called the few, in reference to Winston Churchill's famous speech about the pilots of the Battle of Britain. Let's see. Indian superhumans are called Vidiharas, the learned ones. Jewish superhumans, Nephilim. Russian superhumans, Severch Ludi, supermen. In the Axis, German superhumans are Ubermen, or Ubermenschen, or Supermen, while few Japanese superhumans are called Gaki, hungry ghosts. Italian superhumans are called Custodes, guardians. Early on, talents were called superhumans, parahumans, or supermen. Sometimes these old phrases are still used, but it is rare. The scientific community still tends to call them parahumans, and some newspapers still print headlines using the word super just to drum up sales to the public. However, the amazing people who can do the impossible will all always just be talents. Talents routinely break laws that no one believed could be broken by anyone or anything. Name a physical constant or law, inertia, mass, gravity, what have you, and some talent has already been already bent, twisted, and broken it and made it look easy. There are speedsters who move 300 miles an hour on the ground at a jog and don't mess their hair. There are strongmen who weigh 98 pounds, soaking wet, but can stop an oncoming truck with a single outstretched hand. With no leverage, they bring the roaring vehicle to a full stop without even leaving footprints in the dirt. There are men who fly faster than sound, whose skin is unmarked by the incredible wind pressure, and who seem to stay warm and breathe at impossible altitudes. There was a man named Lloyd Fight, also known as Bulldog. His last name is spelled F-E-I-T, and he lifted an 8.5-ton half-track over his head during the 1940 Lend-Lease tour of the U.S. Talents alternately fascinate and disgust scientists. There is a perverse feeling of wonder and horror that only scientists can feel in watching everything they thought they knew being ripped to pieces by watching a man fly, lift a truck, or move objects with his mind. Studies of talent abilities hint at the mechanics behind these strange occurrences, but no definitive proof is ever found of just how the hell they are doing these things that no one is supposed to be able to do. All the scientists can do is document how much talents warp reality with their powers. As far as is known, despite what their powers may be to enable them to accomplish these things, talents never actually cease physically being human beings. There are talents who appear to transform into animals, both fictional and factual. However, as far as these abilities are understood, no actual transformation occurs outside the minds of those observing the talent. What we are talking about here is the AC, let's see, hang on a second, I've got it. All right. In combat, talents are quite effective against normal humans. First of all, when talents attempt to use their powers directly in other talents, they report a feeling of resistance or interference, lessening or preventing their use of their ability. Second, when two talents see each other and one or more is using their powers, each automatically knows the other is a talent. The parahuman, or what is termed transhumanism, is a movement which advocates the need to develop better humans, or what are now called post-humans, by means of eliminating aging and enhancing a human's intellectual, physical, and psychological capacities. The movement strongly supports the ongoing researches to create human-animal hybrids. Okay? The Academy of Medical Sciences, which published a report in July. I have a copy of the report. If you want a copy of it, write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com and I will send it to you. It's about 120 pages. Examining the use of animals containing human material. It even has an acronym, ACHM, Animals Containing Human Material. According to researchers, human-animal hybrids help understand human bodily functions and human diseases where cell or computer-based alternatives alone will not suffice, and it is morally or practically impossible to do the necessary studies in living people. ACHMs also help determine the role of a specific piece of human DNA, our genetic material, by seeing what effect it has in a living animal, and to test and develop methods of diagnosis, drugs, or other treatment for human disease. It's still ethical to test things on an animal and not on a human. The ACHM research synopsis says animals can be genetically altered by adding it to the human genes, by adding to it the human genes that you wish to study, or by changing its genes so they are the same as those in man. I guarantee you it's only a matter of time before it works the other way. The paper denies likely cross-fertilization of humans and animals by means of fusing human eggs or sperms with animals' reproductive mechanisms. Human reproductive tissues can be implanted in various places, such as under the skin, in the recipient animal, rather than into its own reproductive system. So there's little possibility of fertilization. Nevertheless, if in case an inadvertent cross-fertilization occurs, it is very unlikely that the event would result in a viable embryo. Not impossible, just unlikely. Researchers admit the possibilities of human appearance or behavioral traits. The ACHMs and express their concern about blurring of these physical looks and behavior boundaries. In other words, a primate that looks very human, maybe loses all its hair and has a human face, but it's still a primate. They also answer the issue of introducing human memory into primates. If there is any certainty over the possibility, possible changes to an animal's brain function following a procedure, the work should proceed cautiously and incrementally, a la Planet of the Apes. That's exactly what happened in the movie. Maybe it was a little bit to kind of get us, you know, aware of what we might see. So it's hard to tell. I can tell you that this is a blurry line, but I can also tell you that if there's a wealthy actress out there who's wrinkling, and she sees a way to do gene therapy on her skin so that she has the skin of an 18-year-old again, it's only a matter of money. If we see a soldier out there who can go for days without water, or who can stand extreme cold, or who has the strength of three humans, I guarantee if our enemies are doing it, we got to be doing it. Because there's no way we could face an army of superhumans in the field. They would just throw us around like we were children. Of course, we could shoot them, but still, hand-to-hand combat, you would have quite a difference there. So, and we have superhumans called Navy SEALs. But that's what it boils down to. That's where all the money is at. It's either going to come from the very wealthy who want to live forever, and I'm not talking about 150 years. We're talking, as I said earlier tonight, 1,500 years. That's a big difference. You know, King John defeated most of his enemies by outliving them. He lived to be something like 85 years old, and he had lots of progeny. So he just outlived his enemies, and that's how he became so powerful. One of the ways he became so powerful. The other way is he was just ruthless. As you know from reading the Magna Carta, what they had to do to make it happen. We're out of time for this week. It's already 10:54 Eastern Time. So we're glad you were able to come with us, glad you were able to see us. If you listened live, if you're listening to this as an archive, you can maybe see the video as well. We'll see if we can archive that. It depends on how much disk storage space we have. But we'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.